Good afternoon. I'm Patty McGlinchey. Today's class is going to be on the muscle system. The objectives are all there for you if you would please review them. I'm not going to read them out for you. We're going to go right into the material. So the first thing we're looking at is the different types of muscle cells there are, and there are three different types in the body. What we're going to be mainly concerned with is the first one I'm going to talk about, the skeletal muscle, but the other two are important as well. We've got to know them also. So what differentiates the skeletal muscle from the other two? Well, looking at a skeletal muscle, right up there on the slide, on your handout, you have a picture of what the skeletal muscle cell looks like, one cell. And you can also refer to this as a muscle fiber. The terms fiber and cell are interchangeable. So in your handout, you're going to see it as fiber. In your textbooks, if you use them, you'll see it as fiber or cell. It goes back and forth. So looking at this one cell, one muscle fiber, what strikes you as unique based on your knowledge of cells? Multinucleated. This is a bizarre cell. It has more than one nucleus. Okay, so that is a key thing. The skeletal muscle is multinucleated. Now that's about my fourth bullet down there. The top thing, talking about skeletal muscles, this is the muscle that connects a bone to a bone. Therefore, the name skeletal muscle. All right, makes sense. It is striated, so if you look at the picture, you see it's striped. It has that striation. It is under voluntary control. You all have a biceps brachii. If I told you to contract it, well, first you'd have to know what it is. It's the muscle in the anterior forearm. Everyone contract their biceps brachii. All right, I could have said bend your elbow, same thing. You all could voluntarily control that. Versus the heart. If I say, everyone, make your heart stop beating. Okay? Can't do. No can do. So that's what voluntary is referring to. It can be voluntarily moved. Does your biceps ever move without your voluntary control, like you saying move? Yeah. Sometimes you have like a spasm of it or a twitch. So there is times when it happens involuntary, but it can be voluntary control. That's what that is referring to. Multinucleated, the speed of contraction of that muscle, looking at the physiology that we're going to get into, it's very quick, very, very quick, especially compared to the other two. And as far as it's being able to regenerate, meaning if it's injured, being able to divide and create a new cell, can't really do it. It says limited, but virtually it can't do it. Virtually it's almost a no. There are some unique situations, but for practical purposes, no, it cannot regenerate. Limited. All right, the next kind of muscle cell that we're going to talk about is the cardiac muscle cell. This muscle tissue is only found in the heart, therefore the name makes sense. It is also striated. It is involuntarily controlled, as we already discussed, and it only has one nucleus. Uno, one. Single nucleated. So it kind of looks like the skeletal muscle with the striation, but the nucleus gives it away as to what it is. And it does has a little bit different shape too, doesn't it? Versus the other one, I know you have it in your handout to refer to. They look a little different. It contracts moderately, speed-wise, compared to the skeletal and the one we're going to do next, which is slow. And this one also cannot regenerate. And you probably intuitively knew that when people have heart attacks, the muscle of the heart doesn't get its blood. That's what causes the heart attack. The muscle can't contract because it doesn't have blood flow. Those muscle cells of the heart muscle die. And do they grow back? No. That's why people that have had heart attack get what's called scarring or fibrosis of the heart muscle. That muscle does not return back. Their heart's a little bit weaker. Multiple heart attack victims, therefore, have weak hearts and are more likely to have more problems. So that's muscle type number two, the third type, smooth muscle. This one, I feel like, is joined into the gang, but really doesn't look like the other two. You remember that old Sesame Street thing, one of these things is not like the other? Yeah? No? I grew up with Sesame Street. That was like my kindergarten. Anyway, it doesn't look like the other two. Not at all. It has a totally different shape. It does not have the striation that the other two, and it really functions so differently than the other two, but still, it's muscle. We're going to join it into this class, muscle tissue. Now, this muscle, the smooth muscle, is found within the organs of the body. This is the one that you find in your stomach muscle. This is the in your stomach organ. You find this is the muscle of the stomach organ. You find it within your blood vessels. This is the muscle that will constrict the blood vessels. So you find it in all of those organs and vessels throughout the body. It is involuntary. You probably could have told me that, because right now I can't. You can't voluntarily tell your blood vessels to constrict. It's an involuntary thing. And as far as the rate of contraction, is slow compared to the other two. Not a quickie. Interestingly, this one can regenerate. So it can divide and form new cells and heal itself. And that's a good thing for those that are having colon surgery and things of that sort. This tissue can regenerate. The only one of the three. So that's just some background, but really this class could be titled Skeletal Muscle System, because we're not going to talk about the cardiac or the smooth beyond what I just did. A lot of the properties and functions I'm going to talk about, yeah, that relates to all three types of muscle tissue, but we're going to emphasize skeletal. So these properties, these are for all three. All three of them have, let me pull them out, the three E's and a C. Excitability, they all are that. Now we learned in PT, and I'm sure you OT folks learned it too, that there's another tissue in the body, another cell that is excitable. What's that other cell?
Neuron.
Yes. All right, the neuron. The neuron and the muscle cell are the only two excitable cells in the body. And what that term excitable means is that given a stimulus, it can depolarize, it can react, it can contract in the case of a muscle. So it can react to that synaptic activity, you know, when a neurotransmitter comes over into that cell, it can react. That's what excitability means. Contractibility is the ability to contract forcefully. So it can shorten forcefully and generate a tension. And that's like one of those things you probably could have told me before the class, that muscles can contract. All right, so that's the one you already know. The next one, extensibility, refers to its ability to stretch. This cell, you can pull it on either end if you had microscopic hands, and you could pull it and extend its length out without it tearing. It has that ability. Most other cells in the body, you start pulling on them and they rupture and they're dead. The neuron, it has very little, very, very little extensibility. So some of you, when you try to touch your toes, you know, keeping your knees straight and you can't get there, what you're going to feel, like little zingers going into your toes or down the back of your legs. That's your nerve cell saying, we're being stretched too much. It's not your hamstrings that will be limiting you. For some, it's the sciatic nerve. It doesn't stretch. So when you're working with patients to get their extensibility increased, and typically it's the hamstrings, you have to keep in mind that the nerves have to adjust to that too. People with chronic tight hamstrings have short sciatic nerves for their body, so you're stretching them to get the muscles looser, but you have to consider the nervous tissue too. It doesn't stretch the same, but over time it will accommodate to a newer length, okay, over time. So that's extensibility, being able to stretch and not rupture. And then the last one is important. You know, how many of you have ever taken like silly putty and you stretch it out and it just stays that way? Well, if your muscles did that, you wouldn't be a functional being. So the last one, elasticity, means it can go back to its normal shape. It bounces back like a rubber band. So those are your properties of all those three types of muscle tissue, skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. Function-wise, looking at all three types of muscle tissues as well, we got a couple functions here. First one is the very, very simple, obvious function. It produces body motion. Bones are moved and mobility occurs within the body. Feel free to take off your jackets, folks, if you're getting warm. And this is just one of the main properties of muscles, but not the only one. Some people think this is all muscles do. But right now, you're really not moving, but you have muscles working. What are they doing? Digesting your lunch. We're going to see that on our list. What else are they doing? Got your posture going. You have muscles working right now to hold you upright. Your head, it's not flopping over, right? Something's keeping it up there. Your muscles are working. What else is happening right now? Okay, the heart's beating, so we have the volume of the heart being changed constantly with the muscles. Anything else going on? Anybody hot? The muscles actually increase heat too. So let's look at all these things. Posture and body support. Now in this case, the muscles are working, but they're not contracting completely, forcefully to produce movement. They're contracting to maintain a posture. It's considered a partial contraction. So that's another function of muscle tissue. Regulating volume organ. We didn't talk about this one. I mean, all of you guys aren't running to the bathroom right now. You have a sphincter holding some fluids within your body. That's an important muscle function, yes? Okay. I'll say one of the complications of giving birth is that females sometimes lose that ability to hold their sphincter with their urethra. And that's, I mean, you see somebody with that problem, and here they are, 20, 25 years old, and they're looking at adult diapers. That's a problem. And thankfully, physical therapy, I don't know about occupational therapy, but I know that we do work with that muscle to get that muscle to do what it needs to do, regulating volume organ. Organ volume, excuse me. All right, stay with me, folks. Moving substances through the body. You mentioned digestion. That's your smooth muscles contracting in a nice rhythmic way, pushing things through the body. In the sense of the stomach right now, it's really working hard, digesting that delicious meal you had for lunch. It's just moving it back and forth within the stomach, but that helps break it down. And then the last thing, heat production. Interesting statistic there. Muscle contractions produce 40 to 50% of your body heat. Interesting, huh? So right now you have muscles contracting. Holding your head up, moving your hand, doing that. When you wake up in the morning, if you ever are feverish and you wake up in the morning and take your temperature right away, it's usually lower than if you take it a half hour later. Why? Part of it's because of the muscle activity. Hopefully you were sleeping very soundly with your co-Tylenol in you or whatever, and that decreased your body temperature somewhat. There's other things going on, but that's one thing involved. So when you get really cold, you shiver, produces heat. Good thing? Yeah, but it's not very efficient, okay, because it takes a lot of energy to produce that shivering, but it works for getting the heat up. Okay, so that's all your background information. We talked about the three different types. We talked about the functions of muscle tissue, and we talked about the properties. And like I said in the beginning here, everything in this class is testable, even these kind of more obvious things. Now we're going to get into the anatomy of the muscle tissue, and this is where things get kind of dense. All right, so stay with me. We'll get through it together. What we're going to look at is grossly looking at a muscle, which means something the eye could see if we just tore skin off and looked at the muscle, going down to the microscopic level. And we are going to go. We're going to go deep. We're going to learn it all. I'm giving you your full money worth today. So, starting as superficial as possible, we start with the fascia. Fascia is kind of a general term. You hear it a lot, the fascia. It's referring to connective tissue, is what fascia is. So you peel off the skin, what's next? Fascia. Fascia, fascia, fascia. You find it everywhere in the body. Now, it's not just associated with muscles. But when we look at it from a muscle point of view, the outermost coating of the muscle is fascia. And fascia is made up of connective tissue. That's kind of the filler tissue of the body, connective tissue. You have two layers of fascia initially, so going from superficial to deep. And the first one's called superficial. And then the next one down is called deep. So the superficial tissue, let me pull this up, the superficial layer of the fascia is what is immediately deep to the skin. There'll be fat cells within this connective tissue, the superficial tissue, and that's, you know, some people have a little bit more than others. That's because they're storing up for the winter, right? Okay? But you have your fat tissue there. You also have nerves and blood vessels running through this superficial layer of fascia. So it's not just connective tissue. It kind of contains some other things. Again, it's like the filler. And that's your superficial layer. Going to the deeper fascia, this is what lines the inside of the body wall. So we've gone beyond the fat now. Now we're going to the underside of that fat layer, down to the organs and the inside of the body. That's where the deep layer of fascia lies. And I'm being kind of vague on purpose, okay? But I'm going to start getting real specific now as we look directly at the muscle. The muscle has its outer coating of deep layer fascia. You all, I'm sure, have touched raw chicken, raw meat. You've all peeled off that filmy layer. That's your deep fascia, the outermost layer of the deep fascia. This deep fascia also contains some blood vessels, some nerve vessels, and some lymph vessels, which are similar to the blood vessels. You'll learn about them more another time. And it's kind of neat the way that deep fascia works because it helps separate one muscle from another. Again, if you think of the raw meat you've worked with, okay, you can kind of slide your finger between two different muscles within that chicken. It's because the deep fascia is lining all those different muscles and kind of helps separate them. So functionally, that means one muscle can contract and slide over another muscle without creating too much friction because the fascia is there, that slimy stuff, to allow it to move over each other without friction. Deep fascia. The deep fascia comes in three different layers. So I'm just talking deep now. I'm not worried about superficial fascia anymore. Deep fascia, three different layers. These three layers of the deep fascia, connective tissue, are very similar to what we talked about when we looked at the nervous system's three layers of connective tissue. And OT, I don't know if you went there, but the PTs did, so they might, you did? I'm seeing a nod. Okay, good. So the outermost layer of the deep fascia is called your epimyosin. So we're just taking away the norium part and switching in myosin. Epimyosin. Going deeper, the next deep layer would be your perimyosin. So what would it be that surrounds one individual muscle cell, muscle fiber? Endomyosin. So it's organized the same way. Let me pull up a picture to show it. Here we have a big muscle on a bone. Okay? Hope you guys aren't still hungry here. Muscle on a bone. And this is true for animals, humans, all muscle tissue. Surrounding, I'm going to do it in blue, surrounding the entire muscle is a thin coating of the deep fascia. This is the outermost layer. What is it called? Epimyosin. All right, say it. All right, good, get it in there. So there, I got the word up there for you now. Epimyosin, it surrounds that entire muscle. Now, if you look the way the muscle's organized, it's grouped. You have all these red circles within there. Now, those red circles are a bundle of muscle cells, bundle of muscle fibers. So what do you think that bundle's called? Fascicle. Yes. The bundle itself is called a fascicle. It's the same thing with the nervous tissue. The bundle of neurons that were grouped together was called a fascicle. Same thing here, fascicle. And surrounding the fascicle, there's perimyosin. Great. So perimyosin surrounds the fascicle. Right here on the very, very top, we have a fascicle sticking out. That's a fascicle. So all these things in here represent muscle cells. There's a whole bunch of muscle cells, muscle fibers running in there. So that fascicle is surrounded by perimyosin. There's the word fascicle and then perimyosin. And look what happened to the bottom of the slide here. It came up again. Down here, the bottom half is taking that fascicle and blowing it up for your viewing pleasure. And it's surrounded by perimyosin down at the bottom. And as you see, we got things sticking out of it. Now, this is where neuro and muscle diverge. Okay, when we had the neuron sticking out of the fascicle, you didn't look like you could break it down into any more things, right? It was just an axon. Here we can break it down, and we will. But first, what's sticking out of the bottom picture is one cell. One muscle cell, one muscle fiber, same word. And surrounding that muscle fiber is?
Endomyosin.
Endomyosin. Do you think you can see the endomyosin with the naked eye? No, microscopic level. Do you think you can see perimyosin with the naked eye? Time to go to the meat market. Let's look. Here we have an actual cross-section. And this actually is of the lower leg. Okay, so if you are versed at looking at this, you'll know that this is a tibia. And right here is a fibula. Okay, now, looking at this, you can guess that we have groups of muscle. And what they are individual muscles. So right here, colored in blue, is a muscle. Over here, we got a muscle. And over here, and at some point, you'll be able to name all these muscles. All right? It'll be hard to name them on a cross-section view. You're going to name them more within tune with the body. But anyway, what would be surrounding each of those individual muscles? Epimyosin. All right, epimyosin. I want to hear you talk back to me. It helps you learn. So I think if I click the thing, it will do it. I forgot superficial fascia first. Superficial fascia, I always ignore it. That's where the fat lies, right under the skin. So you can see in this cross-section superficial fascia. It's out here in the periphery. All right? Then we'll go to epimyosin, surrounding those individual muscles. Perimyosin, what do you think? You think you can see perimyosin in there? I would have to do some erasing, wouldn't I? What do you think, folks? Yeah, we have a name for it. See, this is your epimyosin. So what would this be deep in there? That's perimyosin. Perimyosin can contain fat. Just like the epimyosin, just like superficial fascia, it can contain some fat. Fat likes to be laid down all over the place. And that's some perimyosin with some fat globulars probably in there. When you actually work, again, with raw meat and you're separating or you're cutting or doing whatever, you'll find sometimes it's very gristly, perimyosin. Sometimes there's fat globulars among it, and it will feel softer. So... yep, there we go, perimyosin. So you can see some perimyosin with the naked eye. Endomyosin, forget it. Okay, you need a microscope. Now, all of these connective tissue layers of the deep fascia, they actually come together at the ends of the muscle, and they form the tendons. And all tendons are is connective tissue that attaches the muscle to the bone. That's all a tendon is, and they're strong. Tendons are very, very strong. If you think of the forces put on them, and they don't rupture all that much, considering strong substances, it's all made up of connective tissue. It kind of lines up. That's what gives it its strength, but at the same time, it's not perfect straight lines. It has a little weaving, and that helps distribute the forces over the entire insertion on the bone. Some tendons have a weird shape. They're flat. I mean, you always think of tendons like the bicep tendon. You can actually see it when you contract. It's a little cord. Looks like a rope in there. At least in mine, it's a little cord. Some of you got big cords, right? Okay. Some tendons, though, flatten out. And they insert just like a sheet would. Those tendons have a special name, aponeurosis. Thank you, aponeurosis. And you have several of these around the body. You got one on the top of the skull. You got one along the lumbar region. Biceps has one. You have the cord part of the biceps tendon, and then you have an aponeurosis, which fans out part of the tendon. So you'll see those when you do the different regions of the body. All right, so now we got the coverings down. Let's go into the actual muscle tissue and look at that. So as I already said, a muscle cell is synonymous with a muscle fiber. Same word, same word. I'm not really sure why anatomy likes to do that. They call a neuron a nerve fiber and a muscle cell a muscle fiber. So be it. I was just reading at lunch. This is what I do in my free time. I was reading muscle stuff in the anatomy book, and it was about how muscles develop embryonically, so, you know, in the fetus. And interestingly, nerves and muscles develop together, like as a unit. And when you get to the point where you have to learn what nerve innervates what muscle, usually it makes sense. But sometimes you'll find, you know, like the big latissimus dorsi, it has a very high innervation. The reason why is in that pre-infant stage there, that latissimus dorsi is very high within the developing fetus. And then it shifts down as it develops. So it's all in the, it's, I thought that was fascinating. Anyway, okay, back to the class. Muscle fiber, muscle cell, same thing. You saw the look of it on the picture that I had up earlier when we were looking at connective tissue. Ooh, that's not going to work, is it? Yep. Thank you. It looks like a hot dog. It has that long cylinder shape. The muscle cells do. Now, a myofibril is going deeper within the muscle cell. And a myofibril is actually those sausages within the sausage. They also have the same long shape, but there's many of them contained within one muscle cell. And they also extend pretty much the length of the muscle cell. Pretty much. I'll fudge there. Let me pull up my picture. I have a lot of words, but I want to go to the pictures. You guys stick to the words. This picture shows you the big muscle coming off the bone. So we got the tendon up here. Muscle, what's that connective tissue covering? Nope. I didn't hear enough answers. I'll ask it again. What's the connective tissue covering right here? Epimyosin, great. So this whole thing here would be your muscle. Right here it pulled out a bundle of muscle cells. What's that called? Fascicle. Okay, this is where I want to get to, down here. This one's sticking out. This is your one muscle fiber. So looking at the bottom part of the picture, the muscle fiber is blown up super big. And the reason I love this picture is because it's colored in blue. What is actually that blue? Well, that actually is representing not the endomyosin. Okay, we're not dealing with connective tissue covering anymore in this picture. That's representing the cell membrane of that muscle fiber. So just for me, the reason I like it is because it really helps highlight the muscle cell. It's what's covered in blue there. So that's one muscle cell, one muscle fiber. What's sticking out of it down here at the very bottom of the picture is the myofibril. So you see how there's a bunch of myofibrils making up one cell, one muscle fiber. Myofibrils, muscle fiber. It gets a little confusing. You got to keep it straight. All righty. I'm going to go to the next picture to continue on. This is looking at the same thing, a muscle fiber. It just doesn't show the whole diameter of it. And what's sticking out here is your myofibril. We still have the same blue coating, which is the cell membrane, okay? So that orients you. Are you all oriented? We're at one cell level here. Myofibril sticking out. Okay, then I will continue on. So the blue cell membrane, do you think it's really blue in real life? No, okay, just making sure. All right, it's not really blue. The blue cell membrane in the diagram has a special name. Instead of just calling it cell membrane, because it's associated with a muscle cell, it's called a sarcolemma. You may remember the lemma term. We used it before. Axolemma was the cell membrane surrounding an axon. Neurolemma was the cell membrane of the Schwann cell as it wraps. OT, if I'm not clicking with you on this, well, then you missed some really good neuro classes. You're invited to come up if you want to next rotation. But lemma, cell membrane, get that in your mind. Now, sarco, where does that come from? Not sarcasm. It's again, going back to root language, and I'm not very knowledgeable on what origin it comes from, be it Latin or Greek, but it's one of those probably. Sarco is going to refer to muscle. So when you hear sarco, think muscle, and you're going to see these terms have a lot of sarco prefixes. So sarcolemma, muscle cell membrane. And just like the axolemma of the axon, that muscle cell membrane is going to be special. It's going to allow some things to come through and some things not. It's going to respond to stimulus, which in this case would be a synapse, the neurotransmitter. It's going to respond to it, so we're going to see a lot of very similar properties. But what we don't see in the neuron that we do see here are these little indentations. Now these, I have to draw another color. Little indentations there. What these indentations are is internal plumbing for the cell. What is found outside a typical cell?
Extracellular
fluid. Okay, fluid. In the muscle fiber, these little indentations are piping that goes within that takes extracellular fluid into the cell. But the pipes don't open up. They don't pipe it in and, you know, have an opening because that would mess up the whole cell's function. We have to keep extracellular fluid out, intracellular fluid in. All the piping does is kind of take it through the middle of the cell and then it connects outside the cell somewhere else. It just takes it through. It's a way to get extracellular fluid near the center of the cell, but not in the cell. Just piping through is all it does. What kind of things are found in extracellular fluid? I'm thinking ions here. Sodium. Okay, we found that with the neurons. Sodium ions are floating out there in that extracellular fluid. Well, just like the neuron, the muscle's going to need sodium to contract, to get excited. And this piping, this T-tubules is the name of it, this T-tubule allows that sodium to get in deep within the cell but still be extracellular. But it's there. It's ready. So when the cell gets its impulse, that sodium can go within the muscle cell. But the important thing you got now is these indentations are called, first of all, T-tubules, and that they just take the extracellular fluid through the interior of the cell, but they do not open up into it. Piping going through, no openings. Yes?
Do they actually drop the cellular fluid in, or do they just let it just start flowing?
It just floats through. There's no, like, suction mechanism or anything pulling the fluid in. It's just these open tubes, and the fluid just flows through it naturally. Now, if you look within the picture, you'll see some blue tubes. And that's representing those T-tubules within the cell. So they don't just kind of pass through. They kind of wrap around things, but still, they never open up within the cell. So that fluid just passes through and goes out elsewhere, unless we have something happening. All right, that was a lot of time on T-tubules. Let's go to the next one, sarcoplasm. Sarcoplasm, very simply, is the fluid within the muscle cell, the sarcoplasm. Just like the cytoplasm is the fluid within a typical cell, because it's a muscle cell, we put the prefix sarco on it, just to make your day fun, sarcoplasm. Myofibril, we already named. How did I do that? Did I name the myofibril already? I thought I did. That's the sausage within the sausage. Now I'm following the order of my handout, not the slide. All right, now if you look at that myofibril, that sausage within the sausage, on the diagram it has some lines on it. Those lines are indicating something, and it's something that it's just, we'll get into this in more detail in a moment, but it's indicating that the myofibril is organized in such a way that it can contract. And this is where the contractions happen, at the myofibril level. And you have a long myofibril. It's broken into sections. And within each section is the ability to contract. Now, they all contract at the same time, but it's not like it goes from one end to the other and it gets shorter. It gets shorter here, it gets shorter here, it gets shorter here. The end result is the whole thing gets shorter. But in doing it, it's organized so only one section functionally works to get shorter. That section has a name, and it's called a sacromere. So again, we have the muscle prefix, a sacromere. Now on this diagram, it's showing it right here with the ziggly line in the middle. Can you see where my blue is coming on? There's a ziggly Z line. If I went further down deep in here, there would be another equal zigzaggy line, but it never gets that far. So on this diagram and on the next one we're going to look at, the zigzaggy line, it's called a Z line, is indicating the boundaries of a sarcomere, which would be what shortens to contract. So the definition I have there is the contractile unit. This is actually functionally what gets shorter and contracts. And you'll understand that more when we get into the physiology. Right now we're just naming things. Now within that contractile unit, you have proteins. And the proteins are diagrammed by these parallel lines here on the myofibril. And at the very end of the myofibril, you see dots, and one dot's thicker than the other. At least it's trying to be. Those are representing the myofilaments. Got a lot of F's in here. Muscle fiber, myofibril. Now we're down to myofilament. Does it make sense that the filament is the smallest? It has that kind of feel to it, myofilament. No? It does to me. Just not for me. Sure, it makes sense, Ms. McGlinchey. Okay. The myofilaments are the smallest thing. And we'll discuss them at length, of course. Nothing simple. But first, let's name a few more things. What is the big yellow webbing-looking thing in there? Well, that's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It sounds like another organelle you learned in your cell class. Which one? Yep, and that's exactly what it is. It is the muscle's form of endoplasmic reticulum. It's just a webbing, and it's a sac structure, so there's actually fluid within it. But it's all continuous with itself. It's all continuous in there. The sarcoplasmic reticulum. Now, the fluid that's within it contains an important ion, and that ion is calcium ion. In your handout, it's abbreviated Ca plus 2. That's the symbol for calcium on the element chart. So that's within the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And if I'm highlighting it, you know it's going to be important, and it's probably going to come out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is exactly what it does. It's very much involved with allowing the muscle to contract. And lastly, is it lastly? I hope, because you guys look like you need a break. Lastly, within this diagram, there's something called the terminal cisterns. The terminal cisterns, all it is, if you look at the word up here, terminal cistern, and then follow the line down, it Y's out. What the terminal cisterns is, or are where the endoplasmic reticulum gets thick. It kind of expands at one spot. The rest is thin webbing, but it expands into some thick pouches. And notice what it's next to when it expands. What's that structure it's next to, the blue tubing-looking thing? The T-tubule, that internal plumbing. Okay? So what's inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum? What ion?
Calcium.
Okay, we got calcium inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And inside the T-tubule, what kind of fluid is in there? Extracellular fluid. Hey, we got some people tracking here. If you're not tracking, don't worry, because typically no one is. So we got extracellular fluid here. You will be, don't worry. I will get you there, or you will get yourself there. And within the extracellular fluid, what sodium? What ion? Sodium. All right. So terminal cisterns. We got internal plumbing with sodium in it, sitting right next to some swellings that have calcium within it. Oh, I know you guys want me to keep going and explain the physiology, but I must break you. Okay? Okay, welcome back. Off a break. You seem a little bit more lively now. Let's see how much your short-term memory is holding in there. Oh, looking at the diagram. Let me erase all my scribble. Looking at the diagram here, what exactly is this diagram diagramming? Is it A muscle, B, a myofibril, or C, a muscle fiber? Yeah, muscle fiber. There is myofibrils in there, though, okay? But this is definitely looking at the muscle fiber is the generic thing. So what is the, thank you, what is the blue outer covering of this muscle fiber? Cell membrane, but don't call it that anymore. Sacromere. Sacromere. Sacro muscle. Oh.
Edit that out of the tape.
Sacrolemma. 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 I got the wrong word in my head. Lemma is the cell membrane. Sacro muscle. So sacrolemma. It's on this right here. Oops, wrong color. Right there, sacrolemma. Okay, so this is a muscle cell, muscle fiber. Sticking out of the muscle fiber, I wish I could block these words. Sticking out of it are a whole bunch of like sausage-like things. What is that called? Myofibril. You could break that myofibril down and look at the proteins. Those are called filaments. Filaments are the smallest. So we go from a myofibril to a myofilament. That's the direction, going smaller. That's usually where people have trouble with this. They get those two confused. Myofibril is made up of myofilaments. Surrounding the myofibrils, you have a webbing sac-like structure which contains calcium. What's that called? Sarcoplasmic reticulum. Think of the endoplasmic reticulum, same structure, but it's specialized in the muscle cell called a sarcoplasmic reticulum. Great. And calcium's in it. Sodium is somewhere inside the cell, but it's really not inside the cell. It's still extracellular. Where is it extracellularly, but within the cell? T-tubules. That's that internal plumbing, continuous with the outside of the cell. Oh, the pen's doing that thing again. I'm not doing this on purpose. I have to go about half an inch away to get it work. So there's indentations. The actual cell membrane, the sarcolemma, goes within, making tubes within that are continuous with the outside. Those tubes never open up within. They just continue straight on through. Alrighty, and sodium is inside there. I think we're ready. Yes. Yes, they can. He's taking it a step into the physiology. Looking at the sodium coming into the cell, which I hope you realize is going to have happening. I hope you're like foreseeing that event. Sodium will flood into the cell. It's going to flood in from the sarcolemma as well as from within the T-tubules, from both. Okay, we're ready to move on to those myofilaments. Myofilaments. So now we're down within the sarcomere. Now I can actually say that word. Let me go a little further here. Here's your sarcomere diagrammed out on a myofibril. This would be your myofibril. All right. And diagrammed into there are the myofilaments, the little protein structures that make up the myofibril. Separating one structural unit from another is this C line that we'll later talk about, and that structure is called a sarcomere. So this is the small contractile unit that eventually causes a whole muscle to contract and get shorter. So let's name those myofilaments because we can. And it's always fun. Looking at that, you have one that is thicker than the other. So one myofilament is called the thick filament, and one's called the thin filament. That's kind of a nice one, isn't it? All right, nothing real fancy to learn and name. However, the thick filament is made up of a protein called myosin. So there is the fancy name you have to learn. Myosin. It's a protein. Myosin. Now the protein shape looks like two golf clubs where the handles, the stick of the golf club wraps around the other one. The shaft, thank you, sound like a golf pro here, but the shaft of the golf pro wraps around the other and the heads of the golf club are sticking out. So if you look at the diagram there, you can see it towards the bottom where you have them twisting and the two heads sticking out to the side. That's one myosin right there. Now, all the myosin, what they do is they kind of line up around each other so that the tails, their shafts, are pointing towards each other. So you have one group on one side, one group on the other side. All their shafts are pointing towards each other. And then all the heads are sticking out in all the various 3D ways, because remember, it's 3D coming out. So there's a whole bunch of these myosin all bundled together, all lined up within that sacromere. And in fact, that just makes one line of myosin. There are thousands of lines of myosins within the sacromere. We're going to be looking at this very 2D, but always think that it happens 3D. Those heads of the myosin are going to be integral in making this contraction occur. Because what they're going to do, those little heads, is they're going to ratchet. They're going to move like this. And in doing so, they're going to move along the other filament that we're going to talk about, the thin one, and end up causing it to get shorter, to contract. Question?
I know it's skipping ahead a little bit, but just so I can orient myself, like I'm missing that little divot where the arrow is pointing to the thick filament, that little dip down in there on that diagram, that's where the end line?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep, and we're going to get to what he's talking about. Okay, thin filament. This one is made up of a protein as well, and this protein is called actin. Actin is ball-shaped. And just like the myosin grouped up together, so does the actin. And when it groups up, it actually forms a twisted helix. Remember DNA, that helix formation? This one forms a helix in how it twists. It has that twisting appearance. And each one of those actins, each one of those balls, has a spot on it that is a receptor site for the myosin head, a place for it to attach on so that it can do that ratcheting motion. Each one has a bonding site. Now, there's also two other proteins that occur or are involved with the actin, troponin and tropomyosin. Kind of sound like twin names, right? I grew up with twins, Karen and Sharon, you know, they kind of work together. So you got tropo and tropomyosin. They work together, the two of them. And their job is to regulate when myosin can connect with actin and when it can't. That's the job. So they lie over those bonding sites, keeping the bonding from occurring when it shouldn't be, when the muscle's at rest, and then allowing the myosin to attach to the actin when you want a contraction or when a contraction should occur. All right. Specifically, if you look at the two of them, the one in the picture that looks like brown licorice, I'm a little hungry for sweets, that one is your tropomyosin. It lays, it kind of wraps right over all the actin bonding sites and twists around the actin as it does it, the tropomyosin. The troponin is the one that's blue, has a funky shape, and that one is kind of the attacher for the tropomyosin. It holds the tropomyosin in place. So without the troponin, that tropomyosin would flop everywhere. With it, it holds it in place on top of the actin, covering those bonding sites. So let's think this through. We're going to want a contraction. So we're going to want the myosin head to attach to the actin at those bonding sites, right? So to get that to happen, what protein do you have to affect, the troponin or the tropomyosin? Okay, I'm getting both answers. And I probably understand why my question's worded kind of vaguely. But of those two, which one is important for controlling? Yeah, I can't ask this in a good way without giving away. Let me just tell you the answer. The troponin is the key here. Because the troponin keeps the tropomyosin in place. And when the troponin is reacted on, when something happens to it, it will move the tropomyosin out of place. It's kind of like the tropomyosin's the dummy here. It just goes where troponin tells it to go. So the troponin will move the tropomyosin and allow that actin head to come in and bind. We're going to get to all that. I'm just kind of getting you thinking ahead. Thinking ahead. Right now, mainly naming it is the important thing. So let's go back to the sacromere again. that contractile unit. We got the fibril, the myofibril. We have all these sacromeres. And where one starts, the other one stops. Okay? They're just continuous. Sacromere, sacromere, down the myofibril. Each sacromere is organized with the thin and the thick filaments. The thick one has the myosin, the thin one the actin. And they're layered over each other. So you have thick, thin, thick, thin, thick, thin. And it's 3D. Okay? Get the 3D idea. It's this layering that gives it the striation. And if you look at this sacromere, you'll get an idea of it. In the middle of the sacromere, I'm going to draw in blue. Ooh, you have the thick. On the ends of the sacromere, you have the thin. On either end. So we got thick and thin. Thick, thin, thick, thin. But notice the thin doesn't go the full length of the sacromere. Does the thick go the full length? No. So when you look at the muscle cell, the muscle fiber, in the very beginning when we looked at the skeletal muscle fiber and we saw that striation, what you're seeing is a difference in color between this portion of the sacromere and then this portion. This portion and this portion. That's what gives it the coloring. Where the two overlap, the thick and the thin, you have a darker coloration. And then where there's just thin, it's going to be a lighter coloration. Where there's just thick, it's going to be in between. And that's what gives it that striped or striated appearance. Because we can, we're going to name all these different areas. It helps, actually, in explaining the physiology. So in explaining all these different striations and how they overlap and all, we can take that sacromere and name a whole bunch of things. First thing we're going to name is the M line. The M line runs right down the middle of the sacromere. I love this picture. You have the same one in your handout. It shows you it on the diagram of the sacromere, and then below it shows you the actin and the myosin diagrammed out to correspond so you can see exactly what's forming the lines. So M line is where those myosin shafts were meeting, the very center. Extending out from the end line, you have shaft and then myosin head. Shaft, myosin head. Shaft, myosin heads. Okay, but at the very center there, you don't have any myosin heads. All you have is shaft. And that the M line is where the shafts going from one direction connect with the shafts that point out the other direction. That's your M line. It's appropriately named because it's at the middle, M, middle of the sacromere. So hopefully that will help you remember it. The next thing we'll name is the Z disc or Z line. Different texts use different terms. Be able to go back and forth. This is the Ziegler. So if I can line this up. So this is the Ziegler line right here and right there. This is the boundary of the sacromere. It separates one sacromere from the next sacromere, and they share Z line, okay? So you have one sacromere separated from the next by the Z line, Z disc. What myofilament would touch the Z line? The thick or the thin? The thin. The thin filament, looking at the bottom diagram here, is the one in yellow. That's the one that connects to the Z line or the Z disc. The M line, what filament is associated with that? The thick. Good. Alrighty, we're ready for the next term, and that's the H zone. The H zone is the zone. Oops. I don't know why this pen is doing this to me again. It's playing tricks on me. Okay. That's the H zone. It's the portion of the sacromere that is only thick filament. Only thick. No thin. H zone. The A band is the portion of the sacromere. Ooh, that's kind of from there to there. That contains the entire thick filament. And within that is some overlap of the thin. So which is bigger, H-zone or A-band? All right, you're there with me. Okay, A-band, the entire length of the thick filament, which includes that part that's overlapped by thin. And then we have the I-band. The I-band is the part that is just thin. So it's really the rest that's not A-band. That's your I-band. From the end of the A-band to the beginning of the next A-band. Interesting thing about the I-band is it crosses over the Z-line. So it doesn't just, the parameters of the I-band are not just within one sacromere. It crosses over into the next sacromere. It's everything that is just thin filament. All right, I made you learn these for a reason. We're not just having fun naming things. When we talk physiology, I'm going to refer to them, and it will start to make more sense and hopefully review it for you, too. Sacromeres, just a clinical note on this one. How many of you feel sore after you do your PT test? Like maybe not right away, but a few hours later, half day later, or the next morning when you wake up? Ugh. That's called delayed onset muscle soreness. And there's, you know, a lot of studies trying to figure out what's actually causing this. Is it lactic acid buildup? You know, we've got some other chemicals going on there. Well, one interesting thing is when they take muscle, a muscle biopsy of a muscle suffering delayed onset muscle soreness, and they look at it, the sacromere is all messed up. Okay, so there's actually damage, structural damage at that microscopic level of the thin and the thick filaments. So that's part of the delayed onset muscle soreness. Just a little clinical note there to keep you happy. All right, this will keep you happy too. Read and laugh. Ha 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 ha. Come on, I like this one. A lot of these things are really goofy, but this one makes me laugh. All right, now that you're laughing, let's put it all together with the physiology. Did y'all get that? Ha ha. All right. The physiology, how do we put it all together and make that muscle contract? Okay? And you'll love this. This is great. I know you will. Okay, essentially, all that's happening in muscle contractions is the myosin head is bonding to what? The actin? The actin? And in bonding to the actin, it then swivels or rickets and pulls the actin towards the center of the sacromere. It lets go. It attaches again. I have to start here. Okay, we pull. It lets go. It attaches again. It pulls. It lets go. It attaches again. It pulls. It lets go. And remember, we got thousands of myosin heads working at the same time, connecting to thousands of actin bonding sites. So we have all these actin coming towards the center, or the M line, of the sacromere. So our teeny-weeny sacromere gets shorter. The same exact thing is happening at the neighboring sacromere and the neighboring sacromere, because it's one cell, folks. So if it's happening at one sacromere within the cell, all the sacromeres within the cell. So I'm not just talking one myofibril, I'm talking the one below it, the one next to it. All those myofibrils, all those sacromeres are getting shorter. And so that muscle cell, that muscle fiber, is getting shorter. And that's what a contraction is, the shortening of the muscle fibers. Yay, isn't this exciting? Let's see how it works. Okay, it all starts with the nerve impulse. Got to have a neuron involved, otherwise I wouldn't be teaching it, right? True. OT, you don't know that. I love nerves. Okay, so neurons involved. You have a neuron. It has depolarized, which means an action potential spreading down the axon. It gets to the axon terminals of the axon, which is where the synapse occurs. It's going to, in this case, synapt onto a muscle. What's that kind of synapse called? Neuromuscular / motor end plate. All right. Remember we had that one motor end plate disorder within our peripheral nerve injury class? This is called a neuromuscular junction or a motor end plate junction. Two terms. Anyway, neuromuscular. synapse going on there. What chemical's being released from the neuron?
Calcium.
Okay, calcium actually is entering the axon terminals. Okay, and that calcium has allowed the synaptic vesicles to migrate and open up. OT, if you know what I'm talking about, don't worry. Open up, neurotransmitters released. That's what I was looking for, neurotransmitter. Now we're going to get more specific because this is skeletal muscle, folks. This is our bread and butter in therapy. We got to understand these skeletal muscles. So neurotransmitter is too vague, too generic. The name of that neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. All right, now you got to know it. Acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is abbreviated or symbolized by a capital A, a capital C, and a lowercase h. Boo, boo, boo. Capital, capital, lower. A-C-H, acetylcholine. So acetylcholine, the neurotransmitter, is released from the presynaptic terminal, the axon. Goes down to the muscle. There's receptors on that sarcolemma. The receptors are specific for acetylcholine. Acetylcholine comes in contact with them. The receptors cause the reaction to start the muscle to do what? Well, we're looking at the sarcoplasm. That's where we are. The sarcoplasm will change because of the neurotransmitter coming in. And it will open up its protein gates and allow what to come into the cell?
Sodium.
Same thing that happened with the neuron. Sodium will enter the muscle cell through the sarcolemma. Very exciting moment in the muscle cell's life. Now, it's not just going to enter from the outside, but all those T-tubules, they're affected too by that change that occurs when the neurotransmitter hits the sarcolemma. So they too will open up their channels and allow sodium to go through the cell membrane that makes up the T-tubules and allow sodium to go into the cell. So this is great because it's not just happening on the periphery out here. We don't just have sodium go in, but down deep where those T-tubules, now sodium can go in down there too. So what you end up having is a mass invasion of sodium throughout the entire muscle fiber, not just around the periphery. It's happening deep too. Physiologically, this is important because that's going to spark a contraction. And we want the whole muscle fiber contracting, all those sarcomeres, all those myofibrils, we want them all contracting at the same time. T-tubules make that happen. They're very vital. So this whole part I'm talking about here is the excitation phase. Do I seem like I'm excited?
Yes.
Okay, this is the beginning. This is the beginning of it all. Contraction is about to happen. So the excitation-contraction coupling phase. Wow, that's a mouthful. Okay, now with this phase, that action potential of the muscle cell, we had one of a neuron, the same thing happens with muscle cells, it spreads over the entire sarcolemma within the T-tubules, and you have the sodium within there. That sodium within the sarcoplasm, the fluid within the muscle cell, the sodium is now in there. Because it is loaded with sodium within the cell, it causes calcium to come out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Oh, some of you are going, oh my gosh, I can't take this anymore. Sarcoplasmic reticulum is just that swelling webbing that has calcium in it. When you have a lot of sodium within the cell, the calcium now wants to join it. It's allowed. It comes out too. So now what do we have floating around the sarcoplasm? Sodium and calcium. We got a big ion party going on inside the cell. Okay? It's party time. So we got all these ions floating around the sarcoplasm. Okay. Now what? The calcium that's floating around the sarcoplasm starts to bind with something, and that something is troponin, the smarter of the twins. Okay, calcium binds with troponin. Troponin was one of the two proteins that you find on actin, troponin, tropomyosin, the twins. This is the smarter of the two. It takes troponin and causes it to change its shape. When troponin morphs, it moves the tropomyosin. Tropomyosin was covering the bonding sites, so now it's not. So guys, it's game time, right? It's no longer covering the site. So what do you think myosin heads are going to do? They're in there. Okay? They're like my little kids when I'm not around and there's a bag of candy out. When I'm around, they stay at bay. But when I disappear, they're in there. Okay? That's what happens. So that's your excitation coupling, contraction coupling. Ugh, all these faces, they're too many words for me. Anyway, that's what happens next. So now a muscle traction can occur. Now this next part, the muscle contraction cycle, you may have heard of it as the sliding filament mechanism. Same thing, different textbooks, different names. This is the part you've been waiting for. The myosin heads. We have them attaching on because they can, all right? But prior to them attaching on, a molecule of energy came by and energized that head. What would that molecule of energy be called?
ATP.
OT, you learn about ATP yet? Then we have to educate you on ATP. ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. They just had their test on it today, so they are experts on this. Adenosine triphosphate is a molecule in your body that stores the energy that you create when you eat food. So y'all had lunch or something similar to lunch. You ate it. It's breaking down. And in doing so, your body produces energy packets, ATP. Your body also takes your food and breaks it down and stores it as glycogen, stores it as fat. And when your body needs energy, it will take those two sources and turn them into ATP so that you can create energy. Okay, so just think of ATP as an energy packet. Your myosin head takes, well, a molecule of ATP goes to the myosin head and energizes it. The way it does that is it breaks down into ADP, which is just a chemical reaction, and in the response of that, it's making that myosin head energized. It can work, but it doesn't work. It just sits there energized, ready to go. What it's waiting for is for the actin bonding sites to be open, for that tropomyosin to move. Tropomyosin moves, it bonds. It doesn't use up the energy in bonding, though. What it uses up the energy in is the next step. So first thing that happens in this four-step process is the myosin head gets ready. That's hydrolyzing. It hydrolyzes. It's ready to go, energized. It's ready. The second part is this connecting. Myosin head actually connects to the actin bonding site. Doesn't use the energy, though, but it connects. The third part is when it uses the energy. It actually swivels. That little myosin head swivels, and that little bit of a swivel shortens the sarcomere. It uses its energy. It gets rid of that ATP and its byproducts. It's all gone back out into the sarcoplasm so it can be reused. The end result is the sarcomere got a little bit shorter. But a little bit shorter is probably not what you want. You probably want a lot shorter. You're probably looking for a full contraction. For it to do that, it has to reattach. But it can't reattach unless it has energy. In fact, this is kind of interesting, it cannot break the bond with actin until it gets an ATP molecule. So it will stay connected until another ATP molecule attaches onto it, another bundle of energy, and then it will release. And when it releases, it hydrolyzes that ATP again to energize itself so that it's ready to go again. If myosin is, if the actin bonding sites are still available, it will bond on again and do the whole process again. Another ATP molecule will come and help it release. It will energize and be ready to go again. It will keep doing this until there's no more calcium. Where did calcium come from?
Sodium.
No, well, the sodium sparked it, but where did it come from? What structure? The sarcoplasmic reticulum. The reason it came out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum is because sodium was there. Sodium will be there as long as the neurotransmitters are being released from that nerve. And that will happen, action potential after action potential. It will occur, bang, 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 more and more neurotransmitter. Once that action potential from the nerve stops, nerve shuts off, the sodium will no longer enter the cell. When there's no longer sodium in the cell, calcium won't be secreted anymore. And that's going to turn off the ability for myosin to connect to the bonding sites, because when you don't have calcium, the troponin's not morphed anymore. When it's not morphed, the troponin slides back into place and covers up the bonding sites. Easy for you to say. Okay, you have this in your handout. This says everything that I just said. Sometimes you need to hear it in other words. So I try not to use the exact words that are in this diagram so that you can read it. I believe you have the full thing. Wait a minute. Oh my gosh, it's not there. Well, isn't that awful? Yeah, I can certainly make a copy of this for you. No problem. I'll do that so you can have this so you can see the whole cycle. It just keeps happening as long as what ion is in the cell? Kind of two, actually. Calcium, which is because of the sodium. Now, someone mentioned ATP. We're going to run out of ATP. Probably not, but if you're really working this cell a lot, yeah, there's going to be some things that fatigue it. That's our next topic that we're going to talk about. But before we get there, I have something very special I'd like to show you. Some of you saw it already. You were peeking when I was getting it set up. Come on, you. There we go. And this website is in your handout. Okay, what this is just a diagram of what I just explained, an animation. Love animations. So what you're watching here is one myosin head. Remember, 3D and many, many, okay? But we're just looking at just one particular myosin head bonding onto the actin. You have a bunch of different things coming in. That little cone-shaped thing, don't worry about. I didn't talk about that. I talked about everything else, though. Flying out of the sky right now. Woo, there it is. That brownish-yellow ball is calcium. Here it comes. Calcium coming in. It attaches onto the snowman pink-looking-like thing, which is troponin. And notice how it morphs it. Here it comes. See, morph, morph. When it morphs it, it's moving the blue licorice, which is your tropomyosin. Okay, here it comes, morphs and moves. The movement allows the myosin head to attach to the bonding site because it opens it up. Myosin head attaches and rivets. Now, the other thing that's coming in out of the sky is, right there, it actually comes in from the ground, is the black ball, which is your ATP. ATP comes in and allows it to get off. So let's see. It's attached. ATP, it detaches. Good. It did it at the right time. It detaches. Right. Now it breaks down, and part of the ATP leaves and the other part. That's all during the swivel. That's what gives it the energy to occur. Question? Say that again. The ball that's leaving to the bottom there? That is your calcium. It comes and it goes. It comes and it goes. Morphs. I'm talking about the pink snowman looking thing. Your troponin. It actually, in this diagram, what it's doing is kind of swiveling it. But technically, it morphs the shape, which moves the tropomyosin. So the calcium's coming in out of the sky. Attaches to it, causes it to swivel, to change. Moves the tropomyosin, and then the calcium releases and goes down to the bottom of the diagram. And then another calcium comes in. Are you tracking now, King? Okay. Calcium, oops, I can't draw on this. The calcium's going to come in from this direction. Right now, the calcium is right here, right now. Okay, it's going to come in from where the big arrow is up here, the big messy arrow. What's coming in from the bottom is ATP, the black one. Okay? The calcium's going to attach like it is on this stopped part here, right onto the troponin. It's going to cause it to swivel, which moves the tropomyosin, which is in blue here. So the tropomyosin will move, which allows that myosin head to attach. Now you're going to see the calcium come onto the troponin, and then you're going to see the calcium release away. That's what happens. There's a new calcium for each racket of that myosin head. So I just said when calcium's there, it's constantly replenishing, okay? Constantly coming and going, coming and going. Let me get rid of my scribbles and turn it back on again. Okay. There we go. Okay. And I used to be able to speed this up, but it won't let me do it anymore. Let me see. Because this is slow. In real life, it goes so quick. Yeah, I don't know how I got it to speed up before. Did I double-click it? No. I did it by accident, so... Oops. Who knows what I did now? Oh, well. Anyway, any questions on this? Down here? Yeah, I think I had it on a different viewer when I got it to go fast. It did? Down here? Right here? So this button here, hold it down. Yeah, I don't think I have the program running that I need. So anyway, try it at home. The website is listed there for you, okay? Now before we break, since we started a little bit late, I'm going to continue on. But when we do break, I'm going to give each of you, we're going to have this pass around. In fact, let's start passing them now.